The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. And on this week's Tech Weekly, we're asking how safe our online movements are from prying eyes, coasting the cutting edge of cloud encryption and speaking with Brian Spector from Certivox. Charles Arthur has a hands-on with a brand new iPhone 5, and we find out what it means when digital media overwhelms TV and print in the Media Guardian's top 100 list. Stay tuned to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Charles Arthur joins me in the studio. Charles, you touched the iPhone 5. Congratulations.
It's not so incredible. I think lots of people are going to be doing that in the near future.
Ooh, dirty iPhone 5. but you touched it earlier than many other people, so you were, shall we say, an early toucher.
this begins to sound rude as well as being on registers.
We're trying to get more people to listen to the podcast, Charles, so let's run with it.
No, police mainly.
Yeah, indeed. What are the three things that you think is different enough to make this something that I should buy?
The first thing is that it really is very light. The weight is considerably less. So they say 200%, and it feels like it's hardly there. It's a bigger screen, but the bigger screen does not mean heavier, and that's really interesting. And yet, despite being a bigger screen, the phone is just as wide as before, so you can reach all the controls with one movement of your thumb, one sweep of your thumb from the top to the bottom, and that's very important because the on-off switch is on the top. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and which I think is going to go enormous, is the panorama camera effect, where you start taking a picture and you can move the camera around, or you can walk around an object, so you can take a panorama moving around an object. The sort of tryouts that I managed to do during that demonstration just indicated to me that that's going to be very interesting. I've been on Twitter talking to people, and the Samsung Galaxy ranges offer this, but you can't do some of the things that does. With the Samsung, you have to stay in one place and move around. You can't do some of the inventive things that clearly with the iPhone 5, you know, what we're able to try out in the brief session afterwards, you know, you can do.
That's interesting. You say that you can walk around an object. Do you think that this hints at maybe a 3D display in the future, or these types of things for prototyping or printing in different contexts?
I think you could imagine all sorts of things. I mean, I think it's going to be something. You will see so many more panorama photos all of a sudden being uploaded to Flickr. I mean, you know, like I say, there are some there now, but it was very interesting looking at it that there wasn't any fisheye distortion. It's not a single photo. There's no stitching. It simply is there once you're finished. And I suspect people are going to have a great time with it.
So those are two things that are different. You said lighter and panorama. You haven't really said much about the actual phone, how it works. You did say that, you know, it's still got the same size screen, but
No, it's a larger screen.
A larger screen, but it still allows you to use one thumb movement, which is important, yeah.
Well, a lot of the other stuff is stuff that, you know, really I couldn't try in the venue. So there's Siri, which is meant to have a lot more features, especially in the UK. Again, I couldn't try this out there, but the expectation is it will be able to do things like find restaurants, do navigation, you know, so you tell it to do navigation, it will do that, and that you'll be able to just, you know, control the whole phone from Siri. Whereas Siri last year, people thought it was a bit of a bar. What they're promising for Siri this time around looks as though it's going to be a lot more featureful. And of course, there's the maps. Again, I wasn't able to try the maps out in any detail, but it looks as though, you know, from what is being promised, the UK maps are going to be, you know, really quite interesting. Certainly the addition of Turn by Turn, which is on the roster of things that are meant to be up for the iPhone 5, the iPhone 4S, iPhone 4, iPhone 3GS in the UK, with iOS 6 when that is released, which is happening on, I believe, Wednesday. That's going to make a lot of phones a lot more useful.
This week, the Media Guardian released its annual roster of its top 100 people in the industry. And this year, Larry Page of Google is at the top. Charles, why?
because Google is becoming much more of a content company than ever it was before. It took over the Frommer's travel guides. That was one of the things that it did. YouTube is starting to generate its own content. You know, Google is putting big money into paying people to create content there. Of course, you have the whole Street View thing, which is, you know, which is a form of content that it has created, which only it has, which it makes available to make it a destination. So, you know, things like this and, Itta, which is the travel software stuff, these are all things in which, you know, these are all ways in which Google is becoming much more of a content company, and what it does matters to everyone. And there's other stuff as well. There's stuff like search and the way that, for example, it's changing its search results so that sites which have a lot of complaints against them from copyright owners will probably be pushed down in the results. Again, given that Google is the dominant search engine in so many places, where Google sends people is where people go. And, if people are being sent to fewer pirate sites, then, you know, that has an effect on the whole media landscape.
Is this enough to get old media to stand up and say, whoa, hold on a second? I mean, is this an upset?
I think that it's not that big an upset. I mean, in previous years, we've had Larry Page and Sergey Brin. We've had Steve Jobs. So the fact that the whole media landscape is moving digital has been pretty evident for some years. I think, though, that the Google position now is so much clearer, that it's both a company which directs people to content and one which originates its or at least owns content as well. That's an interesting position for it to be in.
And how long do you think before people stop thinking of Google only as search, but start to think of it as a content company?
I think people will always think of Google as search, actually, because that's really how it got its name. That is how it's made its brand. It's like, you know, Microsoft. Everyone always thinks about Microsoft as they're the guys who make Windows. If you look at where the profitability is, it's half as in Windows, half as in Office. So you could call them the Office people, but no one does. And that's partly a consequence of where they are. So I think brands tend to be known by the things that they're initially known for, and these things stay with them for good or bad.
Well, similarly, Amazon's Jeff Bezos was also in the top 100. But way up at the top, right next to Larry, was Dick Costolo from Twitter. What is going on here? Why was Twitter so far up?
Well, Twitter is very influential in the sense that it can drive people from one place to another. It can break stories. So in media terms, it's very important. It can, you know, make a brand go up or down in the public esteem. It can break embargoes. It can get news out from places where it was thought that it wasn't possible to do. Twitter has far greater leverage than its revenues or, you know, the number of people it employs might imply.
Yes, and certainly does it. Can it make money?
It can certainly bring in money, and it's looking to get $300 million this year. So yes, it's I think absolutely Twitter can make money.
Facebook was represented by Joanna Shields in the top 10. I noticed that Sheryl Sandberg wasn't anywhere in the top 100.
The thing about the Media Garden 100 is that it's a UK-based proposition. And so Joanna Shields, as the person in charge of Facebook in the UK, she's featured previously in the 100 when she used to work for AOL, for example. That's because it's about Facebook in the UK and the position of the company here. So, you know, a lot of the other names, it's not as if we have CBS or NBC represented there, because we're looking at the readership, which is focused here in the UK.
I'll find out more at guardian.co.uk. Acer was expected to announce a new smartphone handset last week, but their press event was cancelled at the last minute. Tongues started wagging because people started to talk about their relationship with Google and Alibaba, the creators of the Alien operating system. Charles, that's correct, yes?
That is correct.
Ooh, what a relief. This what
was
happened?
One of the most perplexing stories that was around last week, because there was pretty much complete radio silence. This press event was cancelled in the Far East. Alibaba put out a statement blaming Google for having done it. Acer put out no statement at all. Google put out a very... Well, actually, no. Google initially said it had nothing to say when I pursued for asking for more detail on this. But subsequently, some more information has come out. So what has transpired is that it was indeed Google that pressured Acer not to release the phone. that is the long and short of it.
But why? So give us a little bit of background here.
Okay, so the why gets long.
Exactly.
So Acer joined the Open Handset Alliance in 2009. The Open Handset Alliance was all the companies which got together in 2007 and said that they would build Android devices using the, you know, the Google software. Now, the thing about being a member of the OHA is that you commit that you won't build devices that are incompatible with the Android ecosystem. And Google and Andy Rubin, who's the head of the Android, Google Mobile, got heavy on Acer because it's a member of the OHA, but Alioune, which is the Alibaba-designed fork of Android, is not compatible with Android.
Okay, right. You've thrown quite a few concepts out there. First of all, before we get into Alioune and Alibaba and forking, as it were, I need you to tell me a little bit about why the Open Handset Alliance was set up in the first place.
It was basically Google getting lots of companies together who would build compatible devices using Android.
And was this a kind of safety net? Because previously we'd seen so many different mobile operating systems and you had handsets that couldn't talk with other handsets. And so was this the kind of a convergence, a consortium of people saying, yes, we will design and we won't mess up your system by creating different things?
Google basically, and Andy Rubin particularly, had persuaded them that by joining this, they would have devices which would have a consistent set of applications. So it would have all the, you know, the Google Maps and the Google Mails and the things like that. And that therefore they'd be able to present things to carriers and say, hey, look, we're an Android phone. Therefore, you know roughly what you're going to get out of it.
To what degree do you think that was a success factor in the development of Android as a viable operating system
in
this market?
Gigantic, because it meant that they could go to carriers in the Far East, they could go to carriers in Europe, go to carriers in the US and present not exactly a united front, but they could say, listen, you know, we got people who make things for us. So Motorola was making things like the Droid in the States for Verizon, because Verizon didn't have an iPhone. They wanted to have a top-end smartphone that would compete with it. In the Far East, they could do it. In Europe, they could come to Vodafone, for example, again, didn't have the iPhone, wanted to have a top-end smartphone to compete with. So the OHA, in the sense of bringing lots of companies in, was really crucial to Android's success. And, you know, that's really the reason why Android is taken off like a rocket.
So in comes Alibaba, who's a developer in China.
Search engine and developer, yes.
Okay. They develop their own operating system that is part of the OHA.
They take the basic code of Android, which anyone can do, but this doesn't include the Google Mail, the things like that, the things which Google certifies something to run with to make sure that it's Android. And they take their code and they tweak it. So, for example, rather than searching Google, when they do a search, it searches Alibaba and various other things like that, so that it can run Android apps, for example, but it isn't Android in the sense that Google doesn't approve it. It sort of is Android in the sense that it runs, you know, in very much the same way, but it's not sort of written from the ground up. It's taking the core part, which is free to use. And, you know, it's actually completely legitimate to do this, but it's just not allowable for Acer or any other member of the OHA to take this Alioune operating system and build handsets which use it. So it would be okay, for example, if Amazon was to, you know, wanted to get into China with Alibaba, that would be fine. Amazon already does a fork of Android with the Kindle Fire and the Kindle Fire HD.
But Amazon didn't sign up for the OHA.
That's right. Amazon is not a member of the OHA. So the whole, all of this row hinges around Acer's membership since 2009 of the OHA. It's interesting, though, because it's quite hard to find any, you know, real strong data about Acer as a smartphone seller. They're really not big in terms of the number that they sell. They're primarily known as a motherboard maker and it's selling PCs.
So is this going to be one of their first offerings in the smartphone market, or is this something
they've made lots of them before, but they just haven't had much impact. The carriers haven't really taken them up in Europe, for example, but this was them trying to get into China. And the fact is that they wanted to get in with Alibaba because Google is not particularly welcomed in mainland China. So going with Alibaba looked like a good idea, but that OHA contract holds them back from it. So it'll be interesting to see now whether Acer is going to stick with the OHA or whether they're going to decide that they'd rather not and that they're going to go and go with Alibaba.
So Google phoned them up, basically said, kiboshed on the press conference, we're not so happy with this because of
you signed this contract, right, which makes you part of the OHA. The other interesting question will be, if you're not a member of the OHA, can you build handsets that both are and aren't compatible with the Google Android ecosystem? Because this is what Andy Rubin says in a blog post on Google Plus is, it's fine. You can make non-compatible phones, but you can't be in our gang sort of thing.
So that's it. It's almost like an exclusivity contract. Yet there's no retainer. It's just, here you go. That's it. That's all you get. You've got to develop for us.
It sort of is like that, yes. I mean, Benedict Evans, who's an analyst for Ender's Analysis, said on Twitter that it's a bit like the Warsaw Pact, you've all got to be a member and no one can leave.
Are there any other industries that do this kind of exclusivity? Is this a common thing?
It's not exactly exclusivity. It's more, if you sign up with us, then that's how you do it. I honestly couldn't tell you whether there is the same requirement that you will use the same set of criteria and that you'll work to it. It'd be interesting to know whether whether there is any other industry out there. I don't think, for example, though, that it could be, there's no demand that Acer must be a member of the OHA. It's completely free to leave it, but I suspect that Google makes it a condition that if you're going to be in the OHA, you have to do this. If you're not going to be in the OHA, then you can't be, you're not in the Google gang.
You're not in our gang. Well, if you do know of any other industry that has this kind of contract, let us know at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where all the links are. And you can follow this story on guardian.co.uk/technology. This week, Twitter handed posts by Malcolm Harris, an Occupy Wall Street protester awaiting his criminal trial for disorderly conduct, to New York prosecutors. Charles, what's the story here?
Essentially, this is the latest round in a seven-month battle between New York district attorneys and Twitter. The district attorneys in New York have wanted access to Harris's subscriber info, that is, who is the person who is behind this account and what other information is there, and the contents of his tweets. And Twitter has been saying that it should not be responsible for providing that. It should be the user who is in effect responsible. It's very much an arcane legal battle about how much is Twitter required to hand over about a user and under what circumstances should it be obliged to.
This reminds me actually of an item that we did a few months ago that was looking at the number of requests from governments that say Google and also Twitter get. So this would fall under that banner.
It's very similar to that. I mean, Twitter has handed over the tweets, but it's done them in a sealed envelope so that they are not open to the court. And I think that it's still awaiting appeal as to whether that detail can be unsealed by the district attorney. So it's all still in the process. And it's all actually key to mapping out and sort of creating a legislative framework and decisions and precedents for under what circumstances can information about you be requested by the judiciary.
Absolutely. And this is the fascinating point about the period that we're in at the minute, which is how many legal precedents are being set. Mm. I mean, to be a digital lawyer at the moment must be absolutely fascinating.
And quite profitable, too.
Yeah, indeed. Must go back to university. No, I'm done, thanks. The tweets, the content of these tweets are already in the Library of Congress in the US, aren't they?
Yes, although I suspect that it would not be feasible for them to be unearthed from their... there would be no locus standi, as it's called in the legal trade. There's no way in which the Library of Congress can be in any way involved in the case between Harris, Twitter, and the New York District Attorney's Office. So basically the Library of Congress could tell the New York District Attorney to go get lost because it has no... it can't tie it into the case that it has with Harris.
This is an interesting microcosm, actually, of international relations. Even though it's landed within the U.S., lawyers, I'm quoting here from the article that's on guardian.co.uk, it says, lawyers for Twitter also argued that under the Uniform Act, prosecutors would need to obtain a subpoena in California – before it could demand documents from a company based in that state. So this is all happening in New York, but they would have to then go to California. This was an unsuccessful argument, obviously, but it's an interesting microcosm to see the dynamics between the fact that you've got an incident happening in one place and then you've got the headquarters of the incident, you know, the people who were involved in another place.
It's interesting because there obviously federal law would come into play, and the question of to what extent Twitter can refuse a request from a New York judge actually comes under how broad are a New York judge's laws. On the cloud thing, people might say, aha, well, you know, say the same situation came up in the UK, people might say, aha, but Twitter's an American company, so they wouldn't have to hand it over. But the realities of offering cloud services means you tend to base your servers in the same country so that they're close enough to be able to get the tweets to people quickly. So, in effect, you become domiciled in that country because you have services, because you have a headquarters, because you have an office. So, therefore, you fall under the laws of that country.
And this goes back to an argument or a discussion we were having last week about the draft communications bill, which, interestingly enough, in the last week, Twitter has weighed in on. When we covered it, we talked about the fact that the idea is that it would record all of the UK's digital traffic for national protection, for national security. Twitter came out and criticized this bill, suggesting that it would hurt the UK's reputation overseas because the UK would just basically be getting a bad reputation. People wouldn't want to domicile their servers here if they had to be beholden to the UK government as opposed to their home territory. But is that argument that they're making actually a political argument, or are they just simply trying to protect themselves and other private companies from lawsuits, which is what happened here in the New York case?
I think actually that Twitter is simply saying that that yes, it would make life more difficult, and if you're going to monitor all your citizens, then people are going to think less of you as a country, and also those people are going to find ways around the monitoring. They're going to start using encryption, which anyway actually happens with Twitter now. It's a default that you, when you connect to it, you're on an SSL connection. So I don't know whether there'll be more lawsuits against private companies such as Twitter, but you would simply find that people would be more inclined to try to find ways that would not lead to them being monitored.
You said something interesting there. You said people wouldn't trust a government that was monitoring their citizens. Yet this week in the US, a National Security Agency whistleblower came out saying that the NSA collects huge amounts of digital information on its citizens. So what is this thing, this thin thread, as it's being called, all about?
Well, Bill Binney, who used to work at the National Security Agency, which is the agency in question here, very secretive agency which does enormous amounts of traffic monitoring worldwide. So it was behind the Echelon listening system, which was able to pick out words and emails. In effect, the NSA was behind the system that was used to provide intelligence about the Iraq war when there were suggestions diplomatically in the United Nations that some countries weren't with it. The NSA was providing information to US politicians about countries that weren't going their way, and passed it on. That caused a big row in the UK when it was leaked by one of the GCHQ workers. So what's happened is that the NSA some years ago designed a system called ThinThread, which would be able to preserve emails, phone calls, credit card details, search internet searches, and correlate them all to find links that might point to illicit activity. There were certain safeguards that were put in on the way that this would be used. But what Binney says is that after September the 11th, 2001 happened, suddenly all the safeguards were taken off because the US wanted, or the US government to be precise, wanted to catch anyone who might be threatening it, no matter the civil liberties cost. He's really quite outraged. He's a Republican voter who finds himself now not trusting his government. And, it's a very telling quote. He says, I didn't expect this from my government. I thought we were the good guys. We wear the white hats, right? It's very telling. The NSA has denied that it keeps these sorts of files on US individuals, which is, if it were to do that, there would be very serious constitutional questions about whether it broke the right to privacy. So I think the upshot of this is going to be interesting to see.
And finally this week, the more that we use services that reside in the cloud, the more important it is that we keep things like passwords protected. Encryption is now even more important than ever before. And Charles, you spoke with Brian Spector from Certivox, an on-demand encryption key generator, management and distribution service for cloud-based applications and systems. What is Certivox?
Certivox is a company which is providing a different way to think about encryption, especially of data that might be passed in or out of the cloud. So it's very much about a different way, rather than the incredibly bulky public key infrastructure, PKI, that we have at the moment, where some people have public keys and lots of people don't have what are called public keys, which are in effect sort of digital padlocks that you can hand out where only you have the key. So we began by talking about the whole subject of public key infrastructure. Cryptography is the correct description for it, isn't it, Brian?
That would be the correct description, yes. Okay. Thank you, Charles.
As we think of the way that the cryptography is generally approached, is it's about public key infrastructure, PKI, and the way that people think of it is you have a public key, which is like a sort of padlock that you can generate, and anyone can use the padlock that you make, and then they lock up the data with it, then you, only you, have the private key which unlocks that padlock, so only you can read it. You at Certivox have a rather different approach. How does yours work?
Well, we have been working on some advancements in mathematics over the last decade, which are called elliptic curve bilineal pairing cryptographic mathematics. Listeners, you're going to have to remember that, and there'll be a test on that phrase later. Just kidding. What we have done is essentially made an advancement that makes it much more easier for an application to onboard and for the end user who's using that application to kind of experience the security aspects of encrypting their information. So PKI, as it's normally run today, requires a pretty heavy-duty infrastructure. You've got a certificate authority, you've got a lot of certificate response servers, and you've got a lot of infrastructure to kind of issue these certificates out. So effectively what that does is it takes the padlock in Charles Arthur's name and binds it to literally a virtual piece of paper, a certificate that says, yep, this is the padlock that belongs to Charles. Now, that requires a lot of planning when you're rolling this kind of thing out, because effectively, if I wanted to send you a piece of encrypted information, I've got to go up and try and find your padlock that's got this tag on it, this certificate, out of potentially millions of other pieces of paper and padlocks that are floating all over the place.
And just to extend the metaphor, I mean, the warehouse can be broken into. I mean, there have been certificate authorities which have had hacks which have led to actual, you know, real life.
Yeah, it's life and death. It's life and death. Yeah.
What's the example?
Well, the famous one happened last year with the DigiNode attack. What we think is the Iranian Revolutionary Guards hacked into the DigiNode certificate authority in the Netherlands. They modified their root certificate, which allowed them to issue fake Google certificates, google.com. So Iranian dissidents would be cruising to their Gmail accounts, thinking that they were actually logging into Gmail. When they weren't, they were logging into a dummy site. Giving up their username passwords, the Iranian secret police revolutionary guards would hack into their email accounts and pick them up and torture and kill them.
And they thought that they were logging into a secure site because it was showing the HTTPS.
Exactly. The browser wasn't.
And the certificate would have checked out okay.
That, absolutely. So this whole sort of infrastructure is really 35 years old. It was really invented in a military spec. It was good for point-to-point. And at the time, the use case was the application for the use case was fantastic. It's not meant for a day and age where we're doing really fast ad hoc communication, where things like Twitter and Facebook Connect exist. It just won't scale to the level and the degree that is needed in today's day and age on the internet.
So the way that you have sort of worked with this new mathematics, if we sort of use the padlock metaphor, how does your one work?
Well, so ours, instead of having individual unique padlocks all over the place, what you're able to do is take one generic padlock for everybody, could be for millions of people, and right at the point that you need to make it unique, say if I wanted to send you some encrypted information, I could take the generic padlock that everybody else uses, but inject a unique identifier into it, say your email address, because on the internet, an email address is unique. Once I do that, think of it like putting a little bit of spray glue on top of the padlock, which then all of a sudden turns it into a unique bonding agent, which only you have the key to actually unlock again. So instead of me having to go out and search over multiple certificate authorities and make sure that you actually signed up to get a certificate in the first place, I can just go grab the generic padlock, spray some glue on it that I only know you can debond, and then away you go. And as a result, the ability to actually encrypt sensitive information on the fly in an ad hoc manner becomes possible. And in today's day and age, what we're actually doing is a form of cryptography called identity-based cryptography. So it's really, instead of you generating a public-private key pair, putting that public key on a certificate and having a certificate authority vouch that, hey, this is actually your public key, this is your certificate, and you're just one of n number of millions of people out there. What we're actually doing is taking unique identifiers, your identity, and using that as the bonding agent in real time to actually make a public key for you out of something like your email address or a URL string.
So who's using this and what are they using it to do?
Well, it ranges across the spectrum. Our company has a lot of customers in the defense and military intelligence agencies that have been using it for quite a while because it's actually much stronger than traditional PKI in that it's much more agile, but also the keys are actually a lot harder to break than traditional RSA public-private key algorithm-based PKIs. So you'll find our crypto in everything from Toyota ignition systems to BAE missile defense systems to Intel handsets to chips to mobile phones and, you know, across a range of devices. What we're doing now is actually taking our expertise, which has always been in securing low-level, very low-device constrained memory kind of requirement scenarios, and using that to essentially make crypto run very, very fast and agile on the web. So we have a service called Private Sky, which we just launched, which has a browser-based version and an Outlook-based version that essentially allows you to harness this identity-based encryption and in doing so, have a secure messaging platform and manage file transfer platform that does one thing really, really well that we don't think anybody else on the market does, which gives you the benefit, the user, the benefit of true end-to-end encryption. So the only time you can really send data securely through the cloud is when you encrypt it first on your device before it leaves your device and uniquely encrypt that information for the intended recipient. And that's what our Private Sky service allows you to do by harnessing these really cool elliptic curve bilineal pairing protocols. There you go, readers.
And one thing that occurs is that if the, you know, as you put it, the sort of the spray, the bonding spray for this generic padlock is tied to an email address, what happens if I lose control of that email address? You know, what if the Iranian Revolutionary Guard hack into it or get the password?
Well, that's a good point. And that leads to the second problem that Certivox is solving on the internet, authentication. That's the other big elephant in the room. So your listeners have probably heard about the hacks into LinkedIn and Yahoo, where hackers will go in and essentially siphon off the giant databases that contain all the username passwords of the entire user population on those sites. Now, that is a technology that's been around about 40 years, ever since Unix systems were developed, and it hasn't advanced one iota, save for out-of-band methods of authentication like two-factor authentication, where you'll use a hardware-based token and maybe your mobile phone. The problem with those solutions is that they tend to be very, very unwieldy and too complex for the average user to get their head around, and very expensive in some cases if an enterprise wants to roll out these hardware-based two-factor authentication tokens. HSBC supposedly spends $50 a user a year just to roll out these hardware tokens if you've ever had to log into your HSBC account. And it costs a lot of money to actually secure your authentication login. So that's the other issue that we've been focused on at Certivox. And as part of the Private Sky service, we rolled out the world's first browser-based HTML5 compatible two-factor authentication protocol. And it's based, again, on elliptic curve bilineal pairing cryptography. Here we go again. Essentially does a process called authenticated key agreement. Now, authenticated key agreement has also been around for a long, long time, and that's actually what happens every time you identify yourself to your ATM machine to pull cash out of your bank. Mm. It's a process called two-factor authentication. You walk up to your ATM machine, and you've got a debit card with a big number on the mag stripe that gets read off, and you've got a four-digit PIN, which hopefully you haven't written down in your wallet, and you only put into your head. You punch those two things in, they're recombined into a key, and that key is used to authenticate you up to the network to actually get your cash. We have done the elliptic curve analog of that in your browser, and that's part of the Private Sky service. So essentially when you log in, you're not logging in with a username password, you're logging in with a mathematical token that's stored in your HTML5 browser storage and locked to our domain, and a four-digit PIN. Those two things are recombined into a mathematical key, and that key is used in an authenticated key agreement protocol with our authorization servers. No username password required.
Do you think banks are going to, one of the things that banks have been very keen on is, they have to have HTTPS, they have to have all those sorts of things. I mean, the PKI, the infrastructure around public keys is so big. Is there almost too much inertia to move it out if what you're talking about is a more flexible, a more agile way of doing it?
Well, that's the tell, isn't it? That's the big question mark that's out there. We have already signed up. In fact, we've got a big announcement coming out on the 19th with one of the largest infrastructure players on the internet in the world that will be rolling out our SkyPin two-factor authentication protocol as part of their platform early next year. So the signs are good that while the level of inertia being built up is massive, the level of frustration being experienced by end users and also by the guys who actually have to run these systems, more importantly, is so overwhelming that they're looking for ways out, and we're trying to provide that way out.
Brian Spector of Certivox, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.
That's it. Thank you very much to Charles Arthur, and thanks as well to Jason Phipps, our producer. Next week, we're looking at gesture. Tune in next week to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Grotowski. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.